Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe if you want more and leave us some feedback. Away we go.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. B-F-F-T. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Well, if you follow the NBA, you know about sports columnist Dan Shaughnessy. Had him on the show before, Boston Globe. He's had a hell of a career, and it's ongoing. Shaughnessy has written a book, his memoir. It's out today. It's titled Wish It Lasted Forever, Life with Larry Bird and the Celtics. Book's out now. You can grab it on Amazon. You get it at Powell's Books and other places, Barnes & Noble. Dan Shaughnessy on his book tour right now joining us. You've been talking about this all day. Are you hydrating?
Yeah, I got the water going, the Diet Coke's going. I'm taking care of business. Throat's still going strong.
Did Larry Bird really hustle you out of some money?
Just $160, but if you ever bump into him, he will tell you that exact amount. It's not the kind of thing that's lost on him. He remembers the exact figure. We were doing a radio show like 20 years later, and I started teasing about something. He goes, all I know is I got $160 extra dollars in my pocket, Scoop. And that's what he called me. He called me Scoop. So that was very real. And, you know, your town plays prominent in this book because, you know, the Bill Walton saga, the Danny Ainge saga, and just that's where Larry got the, I think he got 47 with his left hand, and all that stuff went down there. So we always enjoyed our trips out there.
When you sit down to write this book, what was sort of the spark for it, Dan?
Well, here's the thing. It's a really good question. And people thought, you know, when everything's the pandemic these days, right? So pandemic hits and people thought, oh, there's going to be a bunch of babies born in 9 months. Well, no, a bunch of books are coming out in a year because of the pandemic. And that's what it is. Everybody's home. And, there was no games. And I know these shows are tough to do when there's no games. I'm sure it was a struggle. So there we were, and, you know, kind of setting our watch by The Last Dance and watching that every Sunday night and watching that good ball in the 80s and 90s. And then around here, they'd show Celtics classics from the 80s, you know, when the Bird Celtics and then Walton coming on, the 85-86 team at 150-1 at home. And I said, well, I kept seeing my young self on the TV in those days sitting right next to the bench because the NBA hadn't figured out you could sell those things for thousands of dollars. The lowly scribes got to sit next to the bench, and we heard everything. And again, it was a smaller NBA, much smaller. And we live with them. We travel with them. We were on the buses, on the flying commercial, waiting for bags, hotel bars at night, same hotels. It was, except for the groupies and the fame and the money, it was like being on the team. And we were right there for all of that. And I thought, well, I've been telling these stories in bars for 30 years. Let's get it all down. And seeing how it evolved when basketball did come back in the COVID bubble, I remember the scribes had to, it cost like $60,000 to send a reporter down there, and then you had to quarantine for 2 weeks. Then you had to sign a waiver saying you wouldn't approach an athlete if you saw him off campus or a coach. You couldn't go up to anybody. And well, that's where we did all of our best work, was waiting for bags and being in the bars late at night and just hanging around with the team on the bus. It was just very loose, and we were able to tell you what they were like. And this team was really interesting because of the personalities they had and the trash talking that they did and the way they and the Lakers dominated that era. I mean, the Celtics-Lakers finals in the 80s was like Ali Frazier of the NBA. There were three bouts, and it was Larry Magic, and it was just, it really brought the NBA back to a level of greatness. And I know you guys got the championship with Bill in 77, and then moving forward, you know, Bird comes into the league in 79 with Magic, and the league got, you know, no more tape delays for the finals then, and just, you know, and no more staying in Holiday Inns. We used to stay in the Holiday Inn in Richfield, Ohio with the Boston Celtics. I mean, imagine that. It was like, there was no mini bar. It was a vending machine next to the rank pool in the lobby there. That's all we had. It was not today's NBA. I thought the game was a little bit more fun to watch then, the passing, just the beauty of it. Bill Walton was a big part of that when he finished up here playing 80 games in that last season, the big gift that he had. And these guys had great, big personalities. They were very secure in their greatness, not worried about touches, not not fraternizing with the other team or talking about who's going to play with who next year. I mean, Bird hated Laimbeer so much he wanted to make sure he wasn't on the All-Star team. He tried to keep him off the reserves of the All-Star team so he wouldn't have to be with him. So, I mean, it was a different league than you got today, and that's just evolution, nobody's fault. But I enjoyed the league at that time and just wanted to get all these stories down.
The book is called Wish It Lasted Forever, Life with the Larry Bird Celtics. Dan Shaughnessy is our guest. You mentioned Walton. What was his role at that time with that team?
Man, it was so magical because we're about the same age. And, of course, you know, he and Kareem are the two greatest college players of all time and UCLA dominance. And, you know, he had that mysticism about him and goes to Portland and he's got the ponytail and, you know, he's harboring Patty Hearst and all the mythology around Bill. And he wasn't that great for the out-of-town writers because he had the stutter and he was shy and he was mysterious. And I don't know, didn't have much luck with him. And then he goes to the Clippers, which is like being in an NBA jail for those years, and nobody would like that. So he just – and he had all the injuries, obviously, and didn't end well anywhere. And then, I don't know, he kind of sold himself to the Celtics, still injured, but somehow it was like this Faustian pact with the devil. He got 1 year of his career back, one year of his life, his NBA life. He played 80 games in 85-86 while they go 50-1 at home and cruise to the championship. In my view, still the greatest team of all time. Because you had MVP caliber Bill Walton coming off the bench with backing up Bird, Parrish, and McHale, and Hall of Famer Dennis Johnson in the backcourt, Hall of Fame coach, five Hall of Famers. So I just, that team translates into any era. And to have Bill come back, and, you know, his four boys were all, they were little kids. They had a big house in Cambridge, and they were running around everywhere, jumping in the hot tub with muddy shoes on and you know, uncorking beers every now and then. There was a hilarious bunch there. And everybody, they used to call them Halloween 1 and Halloween 2 because two of those four boys were born on Halloween. Wow. I don't think Luke's one of them, but two of them were. And they were hilarious. Bill's wife, his first wife, Susie, I mean, she hired a stripper for Bill's birthday, which is in early November, to come to practice and do the routine. And Casey Jones allowed it. I mean, we'd all lose our jobs now. And Casey Jones and me for writing it and the cartoonist for doing that. And there it was. Danny Ainge and Greg Kite bolted out of there, the Mormons. And Greg Kite's like, whatever happened to birthday cakes? They were mildly offended by this performance. And again, just stuff that you could not do today. And it was just so much fun. And when I talked to Bill for this book, and you know how he gets going, he said, empty the thesaurus when you write this. He said, you cannot overstate how great this was. The Celtics gave me my life back, you know, that whole thing that he does. And he means it. And he named the book. He said, it was the greatest year of my life, and I wish it lasted forever. And that's the title of the book.
Red Auerbach, we always see, you know, him with cigars and photos and stuff. But you were around him as an executive with those teams. What role did he play? Because you had... In today's world, I look at those players like Parrish, McHale, and Ainge, and I say, how do you keep all those guys happy? But management had to play a role in that, and maybe it was a different time as well.
It was a different time, and Red knew parts that fit. And he assembled a team. You know, he kind of stole them all. I mean, Larry was drafted as a junior eligible, and they got Parrish and McHale for Joe Barry Carroll and Snooker and the Warriors. And, you know, Dennis Johnson they got for Rick Roby, which was crazy, Hall of Fame guard. Danny Ainge was a Major League Baseball player. Red drafted him in the second round. And, you know, when they had the team that beat the Lakers in 84, all the starters were from kind of smaller conferences. You know, Robert Parrish goes to Centenary. Maxwell goes to Charlotte, North Carolina, Charlotte. Gerald Henderson goes to Virginia Commonwealth. Larry Bird, Indiana State. It was just a different kind of a breed then, and Red was able to assemble players that worked well together. And that's what Walton loved so much about coming here was just the excitement of being around great teammates who were secure in their greatness, didn't worry about touches or who got to do what. Walton was such a great passer that last year. Ainge would lobby to get into the games in garbage time just to be on the floor with Bill to receive some of those feeds because you watch some of the video, the greatest passing team of all time. Bill would come off the low block, go to the foul line, catch the ball, extend his elbows, and just nod his head, and then Larry'd break from out top, and Bill would just feather it over his shoulder without the no-look thing, and Larry'd lay it in reverse. I mean, you can't get better ball than that.
Were you aware at the time, because you're a beat reporter covering four of those seasons, and were you aware at that time that it was special that you would look back, or are you just immersed in the day-to-day and you look up years later going, man, that was special?
That's a really good question, man. And you're appealing to the exact truth of what's in my heart on this, is that I was not. I was being, you know, beat guy, tough guy, and, you know, kind of making, breaking the news and worried about all that. I had my head in the keys a lot and wasn't looking up enough to enjoy the beauty of this. And that's why it's so much fun to look back at it now and just see the greatness that was unfolding on a nightly basis out there. I didn't appreciate it enough. I wasn't smelling the roses. And, you know, it's just kind of you're young and you're hungry and you're being a tough guy. And it was, you know, Peter Vesey of the New York Post tried to tell me that. He goes, you got to just have fun here. This guys would kill to have this be around these guys. Vesey'd come on the road out on that trip out west with you guys. And he just couldn't believe how funny they were and how secure they were. And the practices were more fun than the games, because it was so much. I think it's Scott Wedman coming off the bench. The guy was a, you know, 15,000 point scorer with All-Star with Kansas City, and you know, he and Larry could really fill it up, and they'd go at each other in practice. And you know, Robert Parrish playing against Walton, and it was amazing fun.
You know, it's funny because you mentioned The Last Dance, and we all watched that at the beginning of the pandemic and kind of maybe walked away going, well, you know, they were really good in spite of, you know, some drama internally. Was there ever drama internally? And if so, like, was it Larry Bird or was it Parrish or McHale, or was it a coach who stepped in and said, you know, we're not going to have that? Or was it just pretty much smooth sailing where everyone understood their role?
It was pretty smooth. I mean, every team has a little bit of stuff. And what I saw the first year I was doing it, Bill Fitch was finishing up. And, you know, Bill's a worthy Hall of Fame coach. But Larry identified this when he became a coach. He figured the shelf life's about 3 years in the NBA. So that's why he did 3 years, and he left after taking the Pacers to the finals. So Fitch is in his fourth year, and they've won a championship. And, you know, he got Parrish off of being lazy and running the floor, and he's got everybody cracking. But they just got tired of hearing it. So they got swept by the Bucks in the playoffs with this team. And it was time for change. And Fitch left, and Casey Jones was brought in to be member of the family and roll out the ball and say, go get them, guys. And they went to the finals four straight years with that combination. So there was a little bit of that coach stuff where, like, Maxwell and Parrish and ML Carr, McHale, a lot of them had turned off Fitch at the end. Larry never did. He was an authority guy. He was fine with whoever the coach was. He just believed in authority. And you had that. And then Burden and Maxwell had a little – it didn't end great with them because, you know, Cedric was kind of a clown. I mean, he still is. The quotes in this book are amazing from him. He was just such a great trash talker and so secure in his own self. And his touches went down every year of his NBA career because, you know, he's a rookie. He's the man on a bad team. And then they bring in Larry Bird. Then they bring in Kevin McHale. And then they bring in Danny Ainge. And, you know, he's not getting the ball anymore. He's got to guard the other guy at the other end, the best player, or Worthy or Dominique or whatever. So, but he accepted that to win, and he got three rings out of it. But at the end, you know, he got hurt, and, you know, Red thought he didn't work hard at his rehab, and he'd clown about it a little bit, and Larry got agitated about it, and they didn't win. You know, they had this great team in 85, and Larry was MVP for the second time, and they got, the Lakers beat him in six, and Larry thought that was because, you know, Max didn't work hard enough, and then, of course, they end up trading Maxwell for Bill Walton, and the world was right again. But Max did great duty while he was here, but it didn't end great. That was one situation where I'd say you had some of that internal strife.
Dan Shaughnessy is our guest. Wish It Lasted Forever is the title of the book. Check it out. You got the story of Larry Bird is enough, but you're hearing it from a guy who was there, saw it, witnessed it. Your daughter, who was one, gets passed around the airplane. I mean, because the Celtics players are all holding her, taking turns holding her on their laps. I mean, just a different time, Dan. I mean, what a beautiful memoir, and I appreciate you writing it.
Bill Walton's head was bigger than my baby girl at that time. I mean, it was amazing. His giant head.
That's it. Shaughnessy, I appreciate you, man. Good luck to you with the book.
Nice work. Thank you.
All right. Dan Shaughnessy, there he is, Boston Globe columnist, sat down in the pandemic and just said, you know what, why not? Life with the Larry Bird Celtics. You know, it's an interesting read, and there's a trailblazer photo on the cover. It's Larry and Robert Parrish and Kevin McHale boxing out a Blazer big man. You know, probably a memory that a lot of Blazer fans have. Leave it here. Coming up later this hour, Bruce Barnum, Portland State coach. But first, we'll play Punch and Audio, and that's next. So from Dan Shaughnessy, made me want to read the book, Wish It Lasted Forever's out, Amazon and other places. We're going to play some Punch It audio. It is the best sound from all around. Let's do it.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth Headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
Presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Blazers went small in the fourth quarter. Chauncey Billups said, hey, it was situational. Yusuf Nurkic, Robert Covington, not playing in the fourth quarter. Is that an indication of things to come? Here's Chauncey. Punch it.
No, that's not an indication of what's going on. I just think, again, when you are deep, you know, and you have to kind of play and make adjustments based on what the other team is doing. They were playing small. They start small. I wanted to play us small so we can kind of switch everything. So, no, that has nothing to do with anything going forward. It had everything to do with today's game.
To be determined, though, I think, couldn't help but think about it after the Blazers were so lackadaisical on Sunday. Is Chauncey Billups rewarding the guys that are playing hard? Peter, was it just situational?
I think it was partially situational, but it's no accident that Yusuf Nurkic and Robert Covington both sat in the fourth.
Bill Belichick, another coach, was asked by a reporter why the Patriots seem to play better as the season goes on. Here's Belichick. Punch it.
Yeah. Well, believe it or not, Chris, we try to play well all the time. So maybe it doesn't look that way, but we actually try to. So, you know, this week it'll just be about getting ready for Atlanta and, you know, another NFC team that we don't know very well. So we'll do our best that we can to prepare and familiarize ourselves with the players as well as the schemes and be ready to go.
Can't decide if I like Bill Belichick or hate Bill Belichick. I get what he's trying to do there, but I also think that was a fair question. Reporter's not trying to be crummy, but why is it that you seem to play better down the stretch? Like, help people understand that. That's a fair question. I also understand that it's kind of funny the way Belichick responded to it. Jimmy Garoppolo! He looked pretty good last night. Monday Night Football, Super Niners cruising. Punch it.
Going on fourth and five from the LA 40. Garoppolo got it across. And it's Samuel breaking away. Touchdown, 49ers. And Garoppolo doesn't care what the analytics community said.
You have to play with better vision. If you're Nick Scott and you're an offside curl defender, you have to be able to make that tackle. You cannot let that out the gate.
Debo. He didn't have to snatch that one. Somebody gave that one to him. Look at the chain on him. What a night.
Big night for the Niners as they cruise on Monday Night Football against Peter Samson's Rams. 31-10. Peter, did you see it coming?
Man, no, not at all. I mean, the Rams are great. They had already played their bad, you know, performance last week. Shocked me.
Jimmy Garoppolo now 5-0 career against the Rams. Guys, help me with the NFL. Packers are good. Anybody else? You know? Patriots? Anybody?
Yeah, the Bucs will be there, John. The Bucs will be there.
You think so?
Yeah. Yeah. They'll find a way.
Washington football team? What happened there with that
one? We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Faced
Truth. Sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Faced Truth radio show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Faced Truth radio show. Thanks for listening.